Good morning, maybe good evening or good afternoon for those who are watching. Hi, my name is Vivian Acqua, and I'm a certified diversity executive. And I'm looking forward to having this conversation with Bookie today. And let me see, let me catch the bio for today's session, right? So Bookie is a leading expert on workplace bias navigation. He's the founder and CEO of London-based Diverse City Think Tank, creator of IDO methodology, and also the bias navigation test. He's also the author of I Don't Understand, Navigating Unconscious Biases or Navigating Unconscious Bias in the Workplace. So if you don't know about his book, look it up on Amazon and all the bookstores so that you can grab it. But I am curious. You came recommended by my dear friend Maya Lime Fleur, and those who come recommended, I have to pursue. So welcome, Buki, for joining this conversation. I'm curious, and let's start with an icebreaker. Who are you personally and professionally?
Well, yeah, personally, I'm my background. I'm English. I'm British. I was My heritage is Nigerian, West African, and I guess that says a lot about who I am. I'm a. I guess I would describe myself as a observant, introspective individual. Make sense of the world first from looking inside, and then looking outside and seeing if there's a fit between what I see inside and what's happening outside, and trying to make sense of that. And I guess that was at the core of my need to come up with the IDU methodology.
I don't understand,
Yeah, I
right?
don't understand. Because when I look, I run a set as apart from my bias navigation practice, I also my DEI practice, I also run a sales training consultancy and practice. And when I first started that, I would go into organizations and I'd be and I would speak, and some people say to me, "Oh, you speak so well." And I used to think, "Well, what do you mean I speak so well? What are you trying to say?" It's like a backhanded compliment. Just because I'm a black guy, you're saying I speak so well. That was my thought process. And I thought, going down the escalator or going down the stairs or in the lift, I think, or elevator if you're in the States, right? I would think to myself, well, hang on, maybe they just thought I spoke well. What's the matter with that? So this thing would do my head in, because I would hear this, "You speak so well," and I wasn't sure if it was a backhanded compliment or if it was just an actual compliment. And the worst thing as well, is that it would always happen in the morning. So it ended up ruining my lunch. And lunch is way too good to be ruined, right? So I thought, I need to really sort this out, because I'm going to have years of poor lunches. And I was. So I
So
came up.
how did you battle this then? Did you ask somebody?
No, I decided that I would determine how I would respond. And I would always give people the benefit of the doubt. Why
True.
not? Less for them and more for me, but more for
True.
both of us. It's a way
True.
of de-escalating any kind of tension in you and any potential tension in in the other person. So I'd always give people the benefit of the doubt,
True.
but
We can do better.
I would always call the bias out, the sense bias out, and give the benefit of that, but call it out in a light way. So light reconditioning, light reconditioning. So I would, so if a person said now to me, "You speak so well," I say, "Fine, thank you. So do you, thank you." But if I felt there was something there, I might say, "Oh, you sound surprised." And then I'd move on and enjoy my lunch. I don't need to start having that conversation in my head. "Yeah, just because I'm a black, you're saying it because I'm a black guy. What do you mean? What do you mean?" Which is what I used to do, which would create tension in me, which will affect your disposition, affect the way people respond to you. And suddenly the energy is all ruined. So now I just give people the benefit of the doubt, light reconditioning, move on and enjoy my lunch. And lunch
I like
suddenly is great.
that. I like that. And also for those who are watching, this is an example of microaggression. It can be perceived as microaggression or it cannot be perceived as microaggression, right? It's microaggression is very personal.
Yeah.
And thank you for sharing that question as well, because it does help when people say something like that or similar to that, how are you going to let this marinate and hijack your day? Are you going to do that? Or are you going to give that energy back in a delicate way, strategic way, but still give that energy back where it belongs to and boomerang it? So thank you.
Mm. Mm. And sometimes,
No, continue.
No, I was just going to say, and sometimes, always remember that sometimes there's nothing there. Sometimes it's you.
True.
Sometimes we don't, sometimes it could be you.
True.
That's why you always have to give the person the benefit of the doubt.
True. But if you hear this 10 times, many times.
Yeah. But the person said, I'm a good speaker, said I speak so well. And actually, I'd encourage people to listen to me speak and hire me. I'm not a bad speaker. So actually, maybe they just thought I spoke so well. And why should I care? Why should I
think
about the other? It's like people ask you, where are you from? And you say
it depends on the way they are asking. I'm trying to teach people to ask me about my food or my favorite food from my heritage, right? So that it's a different way of asking the where are you from. I mean, the first time when people ask where are you from, and it's curiosity, because you can sense it. Sometimes you can sense the intention. But when they dig deeper, like, no, where are you really from? That's when I shut down, because it doesn't trigger any curiosity. It triggers annoyance when people are asking the follow-up question and the follow-up question as well.
Here's my thing, right?
Yeah.
Instead of it triggering annoyance, give the person the benefit of the doubt. So a person says to me, where are you from? And I say, I'm from Notting Hill Gate in London. And the person says, but where are you really from?
Exactly.
So then you could get upset about that, but you could just say, do you mean my heritage?
Ooh.
The person says, yes, your heritage. Tell him your heritage, move on, and enjoy your lunch.
I will practice that. I will practice that. But
don't take enough control of it. That's what I mean. I think sometimes the burden, and this can sound controversial to some people, sometimes the burden is too much on the traditional perpetrator.
Why must somebody else
be always walking on eggshells for me, right?
Yeah.
Why don't I just give them the benefit of the doubt? Then nobody has to walk on eggshells. We create our own psychological safety or whatever, in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
By giving them the benefit of the doubt, but calling it out anyway in a very light way.
Yeah. I get that. I do want to continue with the questions, right? So when I talk about humanizing the workplace, what is your perspective on that?
So I think this is great, and I love that title, humanizing the workplace. And, there's many different ways of looking at it, because you have to be, I was thinking about this whole humanizing. We have to be very careful. What is human nowadays is, when I hear humanizing, I look at it from a positive perspective. And I think it's, sharing of humanity and being being nice to each other, frankly, right? That's what I think humanize, being real, being authentic, being nice, because it's easier to be nice than to be anything else, right? You have to work at being hard, You have to kind of shift your your mental paradigm to be hard. So for me, humanization, if that's the right term, or humanizing of the workplace is creating doing your part to be part of or creating a cohesive, harmonious environment. And
I love that.
Yeah, so
I love that. But given the fact that we are addressing your book, where there are some elements that aren't really humanizing, so let's start with the question that. I read a part of this chapter and I chuckled the moment that you were talking about Janet Jackson and Michael Jackson. For those of you who don't know, please Google you were referencing the song Scream.
Yeah.
Again, go to YouTube, watch this video, because to me it resonated the moment that I saw it. I could even, you know, play it visually in my mind. And I'm curious about why are you referring to the song Scream when it comes to the quote, "I don't understand"?
Because when, you know, it's a really good question. And it's because when you're on the receiving end of bias, mm-hmm. you know, this is how you feel. When you sense bias, this is how you feel. You just want to scream. You know, that song goes, "Makes me want to scream." That's exactly. And you see the, like, Michael goes, and it's like really vivid when you watch the video. Mm-hmm. That's exactly how you feel, because, you know, when you're on the receiving end of sensed bias, all these things are going through your mind, you know, like 100 miles an hour. You know, how mm-hmm. dare, you know, why are you throwing, why do you always throw the baby out of the bathwater with people mm-hmm. that look like me? You know, why can't you give me the benefit of the doubt? You know, how many times are you going to check my qualifications? You know, why are you asking me? Why, you know, why do you distrust? I've worked with thousands of companies like yours. Why are you double checking? Why are you throwing negative light on what I'm doing when clearly I've got so many accolades in relation to that? Why would you do that? Just because I'm different, you know? So it makes, this is, and you've got like these things going in your mind, like 100 miles an hour. And mm-hmm. you just want to scream at the person, but you can't say anything. You can't do anything. So you know, you have to keep it in. And this is the most frustrating and most debilitating feeling and experience that you can have. And I don't wish it on anyone. I really don't. So it just reminded me of that video, of mm-hmm. that song, Scream, because Michael was talking, you know, he's a bit of a divisive guy, right? But he encapsulated the feeling that I have or I've had, and I know others have had when they've been on the receiving end of, you know, the incivility, the injustice mm-hmm. associated with career-stifling unconscious bias.
Yeah, and also what I wanted to address, because while you were talking, in my mind, I was thinking, like, for those who are on the receiving end, when organizations want to aim for high productivity, they want to get their business results, their business goals. And I'm just like, why is it so that many people don't understand that unconscious bias can harmfully impact the business goals, can harmfully impact the team goals? Because you were talking about the person receiving it, it's stifling. It's not getting them in a productive state. It's getting them into a low zoning state where they are less productive, and it can also impact other people. But I want to go to your book, because this is a question that I often ask the authors. What inspired you to write "I Don't Understand Navigating Unconscious Bias in the Workplace"?
Because I just didn't understand. Here's the thing. Whenever you're on the receiving end, like those examples I get, when you're on the receiving end of what you sense to be this kind of injustice, this incivility, right? Mm-hmm. In the moment, the feeling is one of disbelief.
Yeah.
And you find yourself telling yourself, I just don't understand how people could be so wicked. I just don't understand the incivility of this behavior. How can you just don't understand? And you're calling it in. And I thought, well, instead of calling it in, what if I could call it out? Mm-hmm. So that led me on a quest to find out how I could articulate the sense of injustice, the sense of disbelief.
Yeah.
That happens when you're on the receiving end of the fight. And that led me on the quest to find out how.
Which is not always easy also to explain to somebody else, right? Because oftentimes it's these secluded incidents that happen, or situations or experience that happen, that happens to one or maybe a few people that find it hard to verbally share what happened to them and how it made them feel. It's not always easy to explain that, because like you said, it stifles you, it gets you angry, all these different emotions that can show up whilst you're going through that. And in the meantime, you're also having a debate, or at least I am having a debate, like, did that really happen? Yeah. Did I crack it? Yeah. Me? Of all me?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And also the other element I should say is that also what I found was in that opening example that I gave, that sometimes I was wrong.
Yeah.
Right. So I felt a sense of disbelief, a kind of, is this really happening? I just don't understand why it's happening. That was where the I don't understand came from. But there was also an element of sometimes I get it wrong. Sometimes I sense bias towards me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd realize, oh, I was so wrong. I'll give an example. Yeah. If you want it, should I give an example?
Yeah, please do.
There was a deal. I talk about this in my book, right? I went for a deal years ago, right? And I went to meet a prospect in this huge Fortune 500 company, right? This was like 23 years ago. And it was the embryonic stages of starting my business at the time, which was a sales training. Mm-hmm. So I could barely spell unconscious bias, let alone know what it was about. Anyway, I went there and I had this meeting with, I met this guy, really a white English gentleman in the morning. He was a chief revenue officer. And we got on so well. I mean, really well. Right. And he said, Bookie, I love what you're doing. You know, you need to come back and present. Your timing's incredible. My management team, the international, they're going to be here next week. Come and present and do to us and do a proposal. So I thought, great, this is going to happen. I'm in there. Mm-hmm. So I came back the next week, and I was waiting in the reception, and Mark, they called him to come down, and he comes down. I went, morning, Mark. And he was cold, like ice, like freezing. So I'm thinking, is this the same Mark that I saw last week?
Mm-hmm.
The real Mark, please stand up, right? He was so cold. Anyway, he takes me up to a boardroom, to his management team. And if he was cold in the reception, he's sub-zero there. He just basically says, present. He barely introduces me to them. So I thought, here we go again. Another white, middle-class, heterosexual male who's embarrassed about putting me forward for a high-profile assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I thought that because it happened to me before in the embryonic stages of my business. So I thought, here we go again. Anyway, I did the presentation. I was enthusiastic. I left. And I thought, well, this is not going anywhere. And I forgot about it. 2 weeks later, I get a call. It's Mark, right? And he says, how are you? And I said, I'm fine. He said, how do you think it went? I said, I always enjoy these things. So I'm more interested in how you thought it went. And I also thought to myself, why are you calling me? You weren't calling me to rub the salt in my wounds. Why don't you just send me a commiseration email, right? Anyway, he says to me, Bookie, my team loved you. They loved you. Can you get here on Wednesday? It was Monday.
Exactly.
He was like, can you get here on Wednesday? I want to talk and get this thing done. Carl, long story short, we got the deal.
Yeah.
Right? So in that situation, who was biased, me or Mark?
You, because Mark was having a bad day. Mark might be not sleeping. Mark was worried about the revenue or some other business goals, right? So Mark wasn't fully there.
Hmm.
That took you off.
Yeah, well, actually, what transpired is that Mark, right, didn't want to show that he was in favor of me.
So he wanted to show neutral. Yeah,
he wanted to be neutral because he was wary of like kind of confirmation, you know, this kind of
confirmation bias.
Yeah. So he was wary of that. So that's why he was a bit away, right?
He could have told you.
Yeah, but maybe, you know, I would have done it in a different way, but actually he was being the most fair and most person that you could think of.
Yeah,
he wanted his people to come to their own conclusion because it was an informal tender, so he wanted them to come to their own conclusion instead of influencing them. And they did come to the right conclusion in his opinion, which was to choose me, but they did it off their own back. So actually I was the biased person there. So that's when I realized situations like that made me realize there's actually two forms of bias. There's direct, what I, in my book, I describe as directional bias, which is towards you because of your race and ethnicity, your sexual orientation, your gender, your age, your socioeconomic background. That's towards you. That's the one that we're all aware of, where people unconsciously treat you unfairly because of your difference, right? But there's also reverse bias, where you misinterpret, where a minority misinterprets their unfavorable or sensed unfavorable mm-hmm. decisions towards them as driven by unconscious bias when they're not. When you do that, that's your bias. So now you become the perpetrator and the other person becomes the victim, regardless of power.
It could have also affected your deal, right? You could have also turned down, change your mood where you did not get the lead, right? So I totally get it.
And dehumanize me, you know what I mean? Maybe demonize me and make me feel like, what's the matter? Make them feel, what's the matter with this guy? Why is he going at you? So we have to be cognizant and wary of two forms of bias. But traditional training doesn't tell you that. Traditional training says you close your eyes, think of a pilot. And you think of a pilot and they say, oh, you see a white male, or you see, you never see a person who's disabled, or you never see a black person. Don't worry, you're not biased. We all have bias. That's what they say. Right. And then what happens is that the training that they do is all about one direction. They never took the training. The bulk of the training is never about the other side. It's always about the majority.
But also what you are addressing is, as practitioners, we have to be aware of our own biases, but also show up and say to our clients that we are not free of bias. We are human. We show up with all our biases, so we are human when it comes to that as well.
Yeah, but unfortunately, the training doesn't say that. The training says what you just said, but then it only talks about improving the situation from one perspective. I call this the guilty perpetrator versus hapless victim model.
I wanna touch upon that, because I do have a question. In the book, you talk about the guilt and the pain mindsets.
Yeah.
How is this connected to unconscious bias?
So, in a couple of ways. First of all, there is most training, most initiatives when it comes to career stifling unconscious bias. So this is, I'm making a difference here between unconscious bias in recruitment, for example, right? That's slightly different, right? So career stifling, the stuff that means that there's very few like black people in senior roles or high profile roles in organizations relative to the majority, to the white majority. I'm talking about that, or women in senior roles relative to men, right? That kind of bias, right? Mm-hmm. When it comes to addressing that, 99% of organizations throughout the world, right? Subscribe to a guilty perpetrator versus hapless victim model that says that there are these people who look a certain way, walk and talk a certain way, they are the guilty perpetrator by default. And there are these people who look a certain way, walk and talk a certain way, and they are the hapless victim of bias by default. And that's an oversimplistic model. In reality, based on the story I told you, and I could tell you others, you can see that it's a lot more fluid. Sometimes the minority can be the guilty perpetrator, and sometimes the white majority can be the guilty perpetrator, right? It's not always white as well. It could just be male, right? Or it could be any number of things, right? So most training starts with that incorrect paradigm, is subscribing to that. And on top of that, that is underpinned, right? By white guilt, right? Stuff that's happened in the past, right? And also stuff that's happening at the moment. And minority pain and retribution. So pain for what's happened to maybe me in the past, or maybe my people like me in the past, and retribution mindset. So pain, so guilt, pain, and retribution mindset. And the problem with that is that when you come up with strategies to address career stifling bias, unconscious bias in the workplace, underpinned by the guilt, pain, and retribution, you will always come up with the wrong answer, because it impairs your vision. It clouds your vision. So you come up with the wrong solutions, right? The wrong solution, like, it's worth me saying this. Wrong solution looks like this: getting all your leaders into a room and spending who will invariably be white in the West and male, not always male, but majority male, getting them in a room and spending inordinate amounts of time on awareness and bias interruption. That is driven by guilt mindset, pain, and retribution, right? Another incorrect thing that comes as a result of guilt, pain, mindset is this obsession with safe spaces. There's nothing wrong with a safe space, but this obsession. I sense bias towards me. I need to go and go to a, I'm encouraged to go to some kind of safe space, maybe some employee relationship group or whatever, and talk to someone or my HR director, talk to them about the bias that I've sensed. But as we've seen, right, there's room for misinterpretation. So what I'm going to talk to the person about, actually, I could be wrong. We don't allow for that. We just assume that when I sense bias, I'm 100% correct. Right? And so what happens is that I go and tell someone who I feel psychologically safe to talk to. Now, invariably, since I'm a black man, the person I'll go and talk to is another black man. It reinforces the bias about the white majority. Likewise, the white
Is this a form of also demystifying the bias paranoia, or is this something else when I talk about?
Well, I think it's just, it is kind of bias paranoia. I just think you asked me about the guilt and pain mindset, right? The guilt, pain mindset, and I add retribution to that mindset, causes people to address career stifling unconscious bias in the wrong way. Encouraging people to go to safe, why not encourage someone, equip someone with the wherewithal, with the skills to create their own safe space in the moment whenever they sense bias? Encourage them to go and talk to someone just reinforces the bias about the white majority. Likewise, the white majority leader, for example, when they sense my misinterpretation or reverse bias, they don't tell me. What they might do is have a conversation maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks later with somebody that they have psychological safety with. Will invariably be a white male or whatever, white leader like them. And they'll say, look, yeah, I'm really sympathetic with the equality cause, but sometimes minorities, these minorities sense bias when it's not there. And that person will say, yeah, that's happened to me, which then reinforces the bias about minorities having chips on their shoulders. And never the twain shall meet. And this is where we live. So all these trainings that people are doing, where they're spending inordinate amounts of time interrupting on bias interruption, which invariably, not that I'm trying to let off anybody, which invariably is leaders trying to correct themselves of this imaginary original sin, is a waste of time. Why not equip everybody with the skills to call it out?
In a way, I get you and I understand you. And that's also in a way why I often provide virtual reality training for people. Instead of imagine it, people can really experience the different levels of biases and also the challenges that can be there, where the reverse bias will be there as well when they can act up, and also they can see the perceived biases as well. Oftentimes the biases that they don't experience will be experienced by them in real life now, or in the virtual reality world as well.
Well, I think that's really, I think that's good, because I mean, it's important to people. I, and what people don't understand is it's, or I feel not enough attention is allocated, is that this thing is happening all the time. It's happening every minute. It only becomes an issue when there's risk, you know, like risk to your career, or risk to your reputation, or risk to your well-being. Suddenly it raises and we become aware of it, but it's actually happening all the time. So we need to equip everybody with the skills to navigate it. Not saying you people are guilty, whoever those people are, change yourself so that these people can be better. Because all
How would you equip the managers and leaders when it comes to mitigating biases, unconscious biases?
Well, I think it pretty much the same way as as I would do with the minority. I think we need to equip everybody. So let's start again. So sorry, I'll stay on your question, but I think we need to equip everybody. We can't have this obviously minorities, and you know, ethnic minority is a very close to home, right? Mm-hmm. Are on the wrong end of bias. We get mm-hmm. it more, right?
Yeah.
Right? But bias is a two-way street, not a one-way street. Workplace right. bias. I'm talking about yeah. in the workplace, right? I'm not talking about racism. A lot of people mm-hmm. mix it all up. I'm talking about workplace. It's a two-way street. So if mm-hmm. it's a two-way street, you have to equip everybody. And here's the irony. Here's the irony of it. Most people, 99% of organizations don't do that, right?
Yeah.
And by not doing that, they're creating an exclude. They're excluding the minority because they're saying that the problem is with these traditional white leaders, they need to change. So then you're actually mm-hmm. excluding the minority from the resolution model. So you're saying, mm-hmm. sit there.
Yeah.
You don't worry. We've got your back. We'll change and your life will get better. So you condemn them to victimhood. And worse, yeah. the minority buys into it. So the minority now is sitting there waiting on his hands or her hands for someone else to change for their career mm-hmm. to get better. So we yeah. need to equip everybody. So to answer your question, what I show people is, one is that there are two forms of bias. So if I was a mm-hmm. minority and I wanted to call out bias, step one, right, is mindset, setting my mindset, mm-hmm. right? That's step one, right? So mm-hmm. setting my mindset means leaving my bag, dropping all my baggage, right? Racial bias baggage, gender bias yeah. baggage, sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. Right? I need to drop it. Even though I have every right in the world based on the representation I see to be suspicious when I'm not shortlisted or when I'm not mm-hmm. getting the same, you know, I have every right, but I need to drop that.
Mm-hmm. Now,
why do you think I need to drop that baggage?
You need to be open for other perspective, right? And also understand that it's about unlearning your habits and your behaviors to become more inclusive.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And also, I think it's the only way I can get to step two. Have you yeah. seen The Karate Kid? Have you seen that film, Karate Kid?
I've seen the series. I've seen the movie as well in the past, but the series also is similar to the movie. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know there was a series, but I've seen yeah. that. Anyway, the movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's this guy in the original movie. So there were two movies. Mm-hmm. The original movie, right? Mm-hmm. There was this guy. He was like a sage. His name was Mr. Yeah. Miyagi. And he mm-hmm. had this protege whose name was Daniel Caruso yeah. or LaRusso.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Daniel was bullied, right? Mm-hmm. And so he taught him karate and he became really good. And he mm-hmm. enters into a competition. And he gets to the final stage. He beats everyone, gets to the final stage. And then he gets scared. He starts mm-hmm. to think of the bullying that used to happen to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets really worried. And he's scared of it. He doesn't want to have the final fight. And Miyagi, the sage, says to him, empty your head. Empty your head. Now, why is he saying empty his head, right? So he can have clarity, right? Mm-hmm. So his vision isn't impaired by what's happened to him before. And it's exactly the same with bias. So step one is empty your head, right? Is mm-hmm. drop your baggage so that you can move to step two. So the question then becomes, what is step two? So step mm-hmm. two is give everybody the benefit of the doubt. So step one is set your mindset. Step two is give everybody the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. But here's the rub. Here's the difficult bit. Call the bias out anyway.
Yeah.
So when I'm doing workshops, people say to me, how can you possibly give somebody the benefit of the doubt but call them out anyway? Well, the way to give them the benefit of the doubt and call them out, right, at the same, or call out the bias, sorry, not them, mm-hmm. right, call out the bias, is to say these three powerful words.
Mm-hmm. And
I don't understand. I don't understand.
That's
it. Yeah. Just tell them you don't. Turn it into a question. So you mm-hmm. turn the statement into a question. I don't understand. Yeah. And what you're going to find happens, right, is that you're going to invoke their natural instinct to give direction. That is, the person will say, what don't you understand? And mm-hmm. now you're into an otherwise sticky conversation about bias, which you wouldn't have been able to. Or the person's going to say to you, let me explain. And now you're into that conversation. And if you still don't understand, then say that.
Yeah.
So we call that developmental inquiry. So you ask me, so that's the third step. So step one is set your mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Step two, right, is give the person the benefit of the doubt, but call them out. How do you call them out? you engage in developmental inquiry. I don't understand, right? Yeah. And what you're going to find is when you go into that kind of, when we teach it, but when you go into that kind of conversation, what you begin to realize is either the bias towards you will call itself out. So you don't need to say you gave the job to her, you didn't give it to me. You know, it'll actually come out. Or what will happen is that your reverse bias, your misinterpretation of the situation will call itself out. Or what will happen is a bit of both will call itself out. And then you can move to, and then you can move to step four and collaboratively agree next steps. Now, if you look at that whole process, it's very collaborative.
True.
But you can't get on that train.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get on that unless you accept the multi-directional nature. So you ask me, how do I tell majority leaders?
Mm-hmm. Right?
It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Set your mindset. When a person tells you that when you sense reverse bias, right? Mm-hmm. When you sense reverse bias towards you as a leader, you need to drop your baggage. Don't assume that a Black person who has an issue with promotion is playing the race card. That's your baggage. Don't assume that a woman is playing the gender card. Don't assume that a person of minority sexual orientation or a person with disability is playing that card either, or all four sometimes, right? Give them the benefit of the doubt. And it's the same process. You just follow that same process. I mean, I've given you the edited highlights version, but that's essentially it.
Yeah, I'm also curious into what you suggest in the book regarding measuring the effectiveness of unconscious biases interventions in organizations. What do you say about that?
So that's a really good question, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there's a couple of ways of looking at it. I think, let me tell you what the wrong way is, right? Right? And again, a lot of people would disagree with me, but my book wasn't written to make people agree with me. It was written, the wrong way, and what the vast majority of people do is they measure their unidirectional, one-way street view type training and initiatives around unconscious bias based on things like asking people, do you feel comfortable bringing yourself to work? You know, your authentic self. Do you trust senior management? You know, all of this kind of stuff. So that seems like the right thing to do, but it's the wrong thing to do, right? And the reason why, you can do an element of that. So don't get me wrong. I don't want to just rubbish it completely, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that alone is the wrong thing to do. And the reason why it's the wrong thing to do, right, is because it comes from a place of eradication, an eradication mindset. That have we gotten rid of all this bias, so now do you feel better?
Yeah. But
as you and I know, you can't get rid of bias because you can't eradicate it, right? So you need to come from you taught me about how you measure it. You need to come from a navigation perspective. Mm-hmm. To what extent do people feel that they are equipped to navigate bias?
Yeah.
That's how you can measure the effectiveness, right? Mm-hmm. You can actually numerically measure that. In my book, I go into a lot more detail, but you can numerically measure that. And you can measure that for at one point, and then you can measure it again. And you'll know if you're doing well, if people feel comfortable in navigating it.
Yeah.
But you can't teach people how to navigate it unless you accept the multidirectional nature. And in terms of results, you can really get granular with that. You can look at departments in organizations, and you can see to what extent certain people, to what extent the whole organization, managers, people managers, staff, feel effective, feel comfortable or feel that they can navigate bias. And that has an impact on how comfortable they are in their role. That also, when a person is confident and comfortable in expressing themselves, they tend to do far better than when they're not.
True.
Now, these are all, all qualitative and quantitative ways of measuring unconscious, bias navigation training, which is what it should be. Unconscious bias training is basically awareness. Yeah. Bias navigation is equipping people with skills to navigate it at every level, from board level to new starter.
I have two questions left. One question is, in the book you talk about peeve or leave exercise. Yeah. I'm sorry, it's later in the day. Mm. Can you share more context about the peeve or leave exercise?
Yeah, so the peeve or leave exercise is interesting. This is your internal GPS. So this is what I think you should use in terms of how you determine where in the moment, when you're on the receiving end of what you perceive to be career-stifling bias, be it microaggressions, be it more complex, I should be partner, I'm better than the person that they shortlisted, they didn't even shortlist me, right? This is kind of complex bias, very difficult to deal with. So when you sense that you're on the receiving end of some any form of bias, before you even react or do anything, you need to determine, one, what you're on the receiving end of. Is it simple bias, microaggression, or is it complex bias, this kind of career stifling, more detailed career stifling bias? And then secondly, how you're going to respond. And the peeve or leave helps you with that. You know, so in the book, I give an example. I say, when I used to, like, gave example, like, at the top of this, I talked about people saying I speak so well and stuff, you know, and that's my head, right?
Yeah.
So what I decide is that I better have come up with a system for determining how I'm going to respond to a kind of unconscious bias. And I used to say, think that there were two ways I could respond. You know, I could, I had what I called the LTFU way, which is I hear something. And that stands, LTFU stands for lighten the fudge up, right?
Oh.
Right? So that was my, that, like, so sometimes you hear something, you don't have to, like, make a big deal. Just lighten the fudge up, right? And then there was the YSPMO. The YSPMO was, you're so peeving me off. You're so peeving me off, right? So I decided to turn that into something more palatable for workshops, right? So I called that the peeve or leave. So the first thing is, when you hear something, you should determine, is this a peeve moment or a leave moment? A peeve moment is having an extended conversation, right? A leave moment is it's kind of just bat it away, like I did with that example. So person says to you, speak so well, let's try it. Person says to you, speak so well. Is that peeve or leave?
I would say leave. For me personally, it would be a leave.
Me too. So I'm just going to leave that. I'm just going to say, well, yeah, thank you. And if I think there's something there, I might say, well, you sound surprised. And then I'll move on and enjoy my lunch. I'm not going to start having questions in my head and losing it. And I've dealt with it. Problem with microaggressions is the cumulative impact. If you can deal with it and shut it down, you're less likely to have another one. But most people don't shut it down. They go to a safe space and talk to someone. And then, person says, all right, let's give you another one. You're right. Person says to me, to you, your people, your lot, you always are. Peeve or leave? Is that a peeve?
Definitely a peeve.
So now we have to have a conversation, right? So that's what the peeve or leave is. It's first, it's your internal GPS determining what you're on the receiving end of. Is it simple bias or complex bias? And if it's complex, you're going to have a conversation, like the model I showed you. And if it's simple bias, then you're just going to bat it away. So the peeve or leave tool, the internal GPS, helps you do that.
Yeah. Okay. That's very interesting. And also thank you for sharing the two examples. I've reached the final question. What is your hope for 2030 when it comes to humanizing the workplace and unconscious biases at work?
So I think my hope would be this, that people accept, in fact, whoever's listening to this, my hope, my wish, my prayer for you is, if you don't already, openly accept and acknowledge the multi-directional nature of workplace bias. Because when you do that, you're essentially saying, we're all the same. And if we're saying we're all the same, then we are humanizing the workplace because we treat each other equally.
Thank you. Thank you for this conversation. And I really enjoyed talking to you. So for those who are watching the live stream or ending, you're watching it now, please watch the replay. And Buki, thank you for joining in this conversation as well. I really enjoyed the conversation. So thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Until next time, everybody. Bye.
Bye.